good day.
Today is Saturday, 11th July 2026, and let me quickly say, before I proceed with this programme, that I will be on my travels tomorrow, travelling back to London with my family, and for that reason, I do not expect to be making a programme tomorrow. It's a fairly complex journey, and I doubt that I will be able to find the time. So please don't necessarily expect a programme from me tomorrow. Well, in the meantime, let's now return to our programme of today, and let's start again with the perennial topic of these programmes, which is the conflict in Ukraine, where it seems to me that all the indications are that the ongoing military crisis that is evolving on the Ukrainian battlefields is now intensifying. Now, as I am making this program, indeed starting from last night, a certain amount of chatter began to spread about another massive Russian strike being prepared against Kiev. We have, in fact, had a fairly powerful strike over the last 72 hours focused on Kiev directly, but not on the scale of the other big strikes that have happened over the course of this month. Supposedly, this is going to be another one of those very big strikes. Now, if this is true, if this turns out to be true, then I think we can say that Kiev is going to be under attack with an intensity that we have never seen at any point in this conflict up to now. With the target not being Kiev's energy system, its electrical supply system, I suspect that attacks on that will start to come later this year. Rather, it appears to be concerted attacks on the weapons production and munitions factories in what I think indisputably now is Ukraine's major industrial center. The other big industrial center, which Ukraine still has and which still continues to function, is the city of Dnipro, and there are considerable industries in Kryvyi Rog and Kremenchuk. But of course, the other big industrial center after Kiev would be Kharkiv, and that now is very much on the front lines, and I doubt there's much in the much production of weapons any longer takes place there. So anyway, let's wait and see whether this big attack does happen. There have been many occasions, there have been several occasions in the past when rumours of a big strike have circulated and then the strike itself has not materialised. I believe, for the record, that the Russians themselves spread stories about these strikes, partly with the intention of keeping the authorities and perhaps the population of Kiev nervous and worried about the strikes that might come. Well, in the meantime, the Russians have been continuing methodically to destroy gas filling stations and gas supply points and storage places across eastern Ukraine. And it's been noticed over the last 24 hours or so that the Russians have now begun to strike at gas filling stations in the Kiev region as well. Now, obviously, this isn't being done simply to inconvenience motorists. It's clearly been done with the purpose of facilitating Russian ground operations. And all of this, to my mind, brings us back to a topic I've discussed in several programs, which is that it looks to me as if a major Russian operation in northeastern Ukraine is coming. And though I don't expect Kiev to be the target this year, the objective maybe I should say this year, it does seem as if, assuming this operation is followed through, that it will place Kiev in a much more difficult and vulnerable position than we have seen at any point in this war since February and March 2022, when forces of the Russian army were located in the immediate neighborhoods, the outskirts of Kiev itself, of the Ukrainian capital. Anyway, let's turn now maybe to what is actually happening on the front lines, and let's focus first maybe on the situation in northeastern Ukraine. Here the Russians have now confirmed that their forces have entered the forest that is immediately to the north of the city of Sumy. They've entered the forest from two directions, both from the north and from the east. It looks as if Russian forces are now starting to concentrate around Sumy itself. And, well, if you look at Russian deployments and Russian military actions, to me, it is becoming very difficult to argue against the proposition that an attack on the city of Sumy, some kind of storming operation of the city of Sumy, is coming. And perhaps even more ominously for Ukraine, the same is now starting to develop around Kharkiv. To the east of Kharkiv, the Russian army has apparently entered the small town of Belikolodyaz, and apparently there are other Russian forces that are moving to encircle the Ukrainians there. And there's also reports of Russian forces entering forested areas close to the city of Kharkiv itself, very close to the city of Kharkiv. The advantage of doing that is that the tree cover provides protection from Ukrainian FPV drones, whilst making it possible for Russian drone operators to take up positions very close to these two cities, Sumy and Kharkiv, and to start drone operations above these cities and to conduct drone strikes on Ukrainian positions inside these two cities. Now, Kharkiv is a much bigger city than Sumy. It's well over a million people. It has large industrial facilities. I've been told that there are extensive underground facilities constructed by the Soviet Union in Kharkiv under the big, heavy industrial factories located in Kharkiv, which, by the way, include what used to be the Soviet Union's most famous, most celebrated tank factory. So if the Russians do intend to storm Kharkiv, then this will require significant forces. And this is where I suspect the Oreshnik will come in, because it looks as if the Oreshnik was specifically designed to deal with these underground facilities beneath Kharkiv, which, as I said, are apparently very extensive. Kharkiv has, over the last few weeks, again become a frontline city. It was also that for a time during the early weeks of the special military operation, though my much missed and tragically murdered friend, Gonzalo Lira, who used to live in Kharkiv, described at that time, as I well remember, a strange atmosphere of relative normality. The Russians might be out on the outskirts of northern Kharkiv. There would be sounds of Russian shelling, but the center of the city, life seemed to continue much as normal, and the shops continued to be full of foodstuffs and other goods. Accounts that I've heard about Kharkiv today paint a different picture. The Russians have been systematically destroying gasoline stations in Kharkiv. Russian drones are already operating over Kharkiv. As I said, industrial activity appears to have come to a virtual stop, and the gas filling stations on the roads leading to Kharkiv have been mostly destroyed. I don't know how much of the civilian population is located in Kharkiv, but given the problems with fuel and shortages of fuel, evacuating these people, if and when the Zelensky government decides to do it, is going to be a very complicated and extremely difficult operation. In Sumy, the city of Sumy, as I discussed some about a week ago, there are already complaints from some of the residents there that they have not yet been evacuated, that no formal evacuation order has been made, despite the fact that the Russians are now taking positions not just in the forested area to the north of Sumy, but also in positions to the northwest of Sumy as well, gradually closing the roads, the supply roads leading into the city. So, anyway, a deteriorating situation for the Ukrainians in northeastern Ukraine. And of course, the Russians continue to pound Ukraine heavily in the sky to a degree that, of course, the Ukrainians themselves are not able to counter. They do continue to conduct drone strikes against Russia. They do conduct drone strikes against Russian refineries. But one cannot compare the weight of the Russian strikes with those that the Ukrainians are able to do. Now, here I'm going to express my own bemusement at the way in which some sections of the media in the West are treating Trump's promise, or was it actual handing over of the designs for the Patriot missile system, and he's promised that Ukraine would be granted a license to produce the Patriot missile system. All sorts of media outlets appear to be treating this preposterous event seriously. I find that incredible, but even a media publication of the seriousness and weight of the Financial Times has done this. Now, to repeat again, there is no possibility that Ukraine can produce Patriot missile systems on its territory. The Patriot missile is an extremely complex weapon. I read that even more complicated than the guidance system is the engine, the rocket engine, which requires extremely careful fabrication and which requires expensive machine tools, very high skilled workers in what would have to be secure factory conditions. I've read a report which says it would take at least 5 years, at least 5 years, in the most optimal circumstances to build a factory capable of producing Patriot missiles. And Ukraine does not function within those optimal conditions. The supply chain challenges would be tremendous. We're not just talking about one type of rocket fuel for this engine. Apparently, for this particular rocket engine, various fuels are used, in particular mixes, and these themselves are difficult to obtain, and there are only specific suppliers who can do it. And, well, the challenges of producing Patriot missiles are demonstrated by the two countries, other than the United States, which actually do have licenses to produce Patriot missiles. One is Japan, and I've done some research on this. Japan was granted the license to produce Patriot missiles back in 2014. It took roughly a decade before production started. Production currently of Patriot missiles in Japan is running at roughly a 50 a year. And obviously, that is nowhere near enough for Ukraine. In fact, it would not last Ukraine for a period of 2 weeks at most. And if we're talking about the other country that has obtained a license to produce Patriot missiles, that is Germany. It obtained this license back in 2022. There's still discussion, apparently, about the site of the factory. Apparently, some preliminary work has been done, but we're still far away from any point where production of Patriot missiles in Germany is going to begin. And anybody who expects Ukraine to overcome these challenges, or European countries cooperating with Ukraine to be able to overcome these challenges anytime soon, is being simply delusional. It is one thing to mass produce drones for Ukraine in European countries based on Chinese components, which are basically then screwed together. Producing Patriot missiles is an entirely different matter altogether. I have to say that, in my opinion, Donald Trump's decision to tell Zelensky that he will be granted, Ukraine will be granted a license to manufacture Patriot missiles, was unbelievably cynical. It's clearly setting up the situation where Trump can say, as Ukraine continues to get hammered, that, well, he did all that he could. He provided Ukraine with all the Patriot missiles that he had. He was prepared to give Ukraine the license. If Ukraine still is unable to protect itself from incoming Russian strikes, then it has nothing to do with him. He's offer or apparent offer to establish a no-fly zone over Ukraine once a ceasefire has been agreed, I have to say, is again, as far as I can see, a similar exercise in cynicism. Because realistically, Trump, as Trump must know by now, Ukraine does not need a no-fly zone once a ceasefire is in place. It needs a no-fly zone now as the Russian missiles strike Ukraine and cause enormous destruction across the country. And, well, I get to say it straight away. I don't think that the United States is ever going to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine. The Russians have already said that they would strongly oppose that, and that for them, it would be a fundamental breach of any agreement and would certainly provoke a military response. I think that there is no circumstance where a US president would send the US Air Force into battle against the Russian Air Force over Ukrainian skies. We have seen in the fighting in the Persian Gulf that even against an adversary far less powerful than Russia, with a far smaller air defense system and a much more basic air force, the US Air Force has suffered losses, significant losses. I think the idea that any US president is going to be willing to contest the airspace over Ukraine with the Russian air defense systems, now extremely experienced and well trained in actual combat, and against the Russian Air Force, is fantasy. And, well, there has been yet another, I think, cruel promise given to Zelensky over the last couple of days. I was reading yesterday in the Financial Times that Senator Graham and Senator Blumenthal and various other US senators have assured Zelensky and issued a statement that after discussions with the Trump White House, they have finally come to an agreement about the so-called sanctions from hell, the bone-breaking sanctions, the massive tariffs against countries that buy Russian oil that Blumenthal and Lindsey Graham have been agitating for ever since the summer of last year. Well, there's been no word about this from the White House. The White House is refusing to comment. Senator Graham is again saying that the purpose of the Sanctions Act is to provide President Trump with tools that he can use to try to force the Russians into a ceasefire. The reality is that the bone-crushing sanctions would not force the Russians into a ceasefire. I've discussed this many times. The way that Senator Graham puts it, it seems as if Trump has won the point that the imposition of such sanctions must be discretionary with him. And in light of a growing global energy shortage, I would have thought that the chances of the United States seriously imposing the kind of restrictions on Russian oil exports that would plunge the global energy markets into an even deeper crisis, having a significant effect on the American economy itself must be very dim, assuming always, of course, that there are still sane people in Washington. Now, having said that, I would also further add that the Chinese government itself said a few months ago, I covered it extensively on this channel and we discussed it on the Duran, the Chinese government has given instructions to Chinese refiners, telling them that they should source crude oil from wherever they can find it. They should no longer pay heed to American sanctions or American secondary sanctions if the United States is serious about imposing Senator Graham's bone-crushing sanctions. It will come into direct collision with China, at which point, at some point, the Chinese will take counter-action and they will begin to, they will probably at that point stop further exports of rare earths. Now, the Chinese, as it happens, have already fired a shot, if you like, across American bows. They've announced that they are stopping exports of helium. China is the second biggest exporter of helium gas after Qatar, which is unable to export helium gas at the moment. Helium is vital in various industrial applications. The United States does produce helium, as does Russia, by the way. But, well, on top of everything else, we're likely to see a helium shortage, or we already have a tungsten shortage. We're going to have, before long, a diesel shortage. I discussed this in my program yesterday. In Europe, they are very short of natural gas. I'm getting conflicting figures about the level of the amount of natural gas that is stored in Europe's reserves, but I'm told that it is extremely low for this time of year, exposing Europe to potential risks in the event that there is a cold winter coming. And, well, is this really the moment to impose bone-crushing sanctions that are going to annoy many people, infuriate many people at a time of a global energy shortage? When Senator Graham and Senator Blumenthal first came up with the bone-crushing sanctions idea last year, there was a global energy glut. There was more oil on the market than the market could absorb. Today, we are in a diametrically opposite situation. And by the way, and for the record, the reason we have gone from an energy glut last year to an energy shortage this year in the space of a year is because of the conflict in the Middle East that Senator Graham, amongst many others, it must be said, so fervidly advocated. He seems, as so often, astonishingly oblivious to the effects of the policy decisions he has advocated. Anyway, I don't believe that this is what the United States is going to do. So again, the Ukrainians have been dealt a further cruel trick. Now, in the meantime, elsewhere on the front lines, many events continue to play out. Apparently, there is some kind of major battle going on in the Barovaya pocket on the east bank of the Oskol River. The Russians and the Ukrainians are saying very little about it. Putin said about a week ago, 10 days ago, that a Ukrainian force of around 5,000 men is being gradually surrounded there. Well, that was Putin. We shall see. And so far, the Russians have still not announced the full capture of Lyman, though I noticed that the Russian Defense Ministry had an interview with the Russian officer who is commanding the Russian troops in Lyman. They published this interview yesterday, and he said that his men, his troops, his forces control all the roads leading into and out of Lyman. So maybe that's a further sign that we're going to see an announcement of the capture of this town. Perhaps the words of this officer suggest that there is a Ukrainian force still in Lyman, which is unable to retreat from the town. And that is perhaps what is holding up the capture of the town. And, well, yesterday I spoke about the reports of the fighting in Nikolaevka and at the Slavyansk thermal power plant. But this morning, Radovka published a follow-up piece on the fighting around Konstantinovka, and they're saying that the Russians have broken through and are now close to beginning an operation to capture the town of Druzhivka, which is essentially a suburb of Kramatorsk, a southern suburb of Kramatorsk, which lies immediately to the north of Druzhivka. And of course, the night before, Radovka also published a very detailed account of the fighting that's taking place around the town of Dobropilie to the west of Kramatorsk. And reports this morning suggest that the fighting in this area is now very intense and that there is indeed a Russian objective to capture Dobropilie and to do so fairly soon. And the Russians continue methodically to destroy gas filling stations around Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, including within the towns themselves. And they are now taking steps to close the roads leading into Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. They've just destroyed a bridge on one of the main roads leading to Slavyansk from the west. So we can see that the siege of the two remaining towns in Donbass, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, is absolutely on and is ongoing, and that the noose around these two towns is now tightening. So anyway, that's a quick rundown of the situation on the front lines. The Ukrainians continue to launch drone strikes. They continue to launch drones against the ships in the Sea of Azov. I've lost track of that event. Just to say, they continue to try to conduct drone strikes inside Russia with relatively less success over the last few days. The Russians say that they have foiled a major operation that the Ukrainians were trying to carry out against an airfield, an airport, maybe a military base, an air base in Rostov, in Rostov region. The Russians have given a detailed account of this alleged Ukrainian operation. Supposedly, a Russian citizen was contacted by Ukrainian intelligence to try to get him to help to facilitate this attack on the airfield in Rostov, the Russian citizen in question, this is the Russian account now, then immediately informed the Russian authorities. The Russian authorities then used him to run the operation from their side themselves. The Russians, as a result, captured significant stockpiles of drones that the Ukrainians were going to use to conduct the operation against Rostov Airport. There is no word of any Ukrainian operatives being captured, though the assumption must be that some were. And anyway, according to the Russians, the operation was successful. I should say that though I suspect the Russian account is mostly true, I doubt that it is entirely true. For example, I think that the Russian citizen who the Ukrainians approached and who then alerted the Russian authorities to the plot was far from being an innocent party. I suspect that he was a Russian agent infiltrated into the Ukrainian intelligence agencies all along. Anyway, that's my guess. I don't know. Nobody, of course, is going to share that kind of information with me. We see, however, that at least some of the Ukrainian attacks on facilities in Russia are almost certainly being carried out by Ukrainian operatives working inside Russia itself. And I am going to guess that this was how the drone attack on the big refinery in Omsk was carried out. I doubt that Ukrainian drones traveled all the distance from Ukraine and reached Omsk. It seems to me much more likely that the attack took place from nearby. Anyway, that's, to my mind, the overall military situation. Now, in my program yesterday, I mentioned the increasingly tough statements coming from Russian officials. Lavrov saying that the West simply cannot be trusted and that the Russians have lost all interest in negotiations. The Kremlin also making very critical comments about the West altogether. Another Russian official, Nikolai Patrushev, who used to be Putin's national security advisor and who is now in overall charge of the Navy and merchant fleet, and naval construction, by the way. He's also made what you might call rather hardline comments. My own view, and I get to say it straightforwardly, is that the Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia, which is going to abate, if it has not all done so already, it has not, in my opinion, softened attitudes in Russia, either towards Ukraine or to the West. It has hardened them. It has further convinced people in Russia that the Zelensky government in Kiev, allied with the West, poses a permanent threat to them. And Russians have experienced the fact for themselves. And in fact, what I'm hearing is that when the government gets criticized in Russia, the criticism increasingly is that it is not being tough enough, not that it is being too soft. Anyway, that's my own take of this. I think there continues to be a huge amount of wishful thinking taking place on the part of various people. There's been an extraordinary long article in The Economist about a Russian businessman, Melnichenko, who, of course, the Economist describes as an oligarch, despite the fact that Melnichenko insists that he is not one, but a businessman, and despite the Economist's own admission that the business elite in Russia no longer has any role in direct political decision making, in which case, of course, they cannot be oligarchs. I've said this many, many times. The expression oligarchs for some immensely rich, and by the way, immensely corrupt Russians, was accurate as a description of them in the 1990s and the very early 2000s. But it has long since had no connection at all with reality. The Economist all but admits this, and it also admits, very interestingly, that a lot of the point of the sanctions by the West was to put pressure on these so-called oligarchs to get them to force Putin to change policy in relation to Ukraine. In other words, to get the oligarchs to force Putin to capitulate to the West. I've been hearing about this ever since 2014. I remember reading, again, I think it was in the Financial Times, though it's so long ago now that I can't remember. I remember reading in the Financial Times, I think it was the Financial Times, back in 2014, at the very start of the Ukraine crisis, that the German intelligence agency, the BND, assured Angela Merkel in June 2014 that if Germany supported sectoral sanctions against Russia, then the oligarchs would either force Putin to change course before the end of the year, that is 2014, or would remove him from office. Well, we've seen how well that prediction turned out. Anyway, the Economist finally, very grudgingly, accepts that the oligarchs, the so-called business elite, don't have that kind of influence in the Kremlin anymore. In other words, that they are not oligarchs. But it still implies that Melnichenko is somehow critical of Putin and hostile to the Russian government and to the Russian political course, especially in relation to the conflict in Ukraine. Rarely have I read an interview where the words of the person being interviewed are so completely in conflict, this is my view, with the interpretation that the interviewer places on them. Because what I read Melnichenko to say, and by the way, Melnichenko is, like most such business people, far from a popular figure in Russia today, just saying. Anyway, what I read Melnichenko to say is that globalization has failed. Russian business people now accept that the West is fundamentally hostile to Russia and will never treat Russian businessmen like him with respect and on equal terms, and that Russia's future is therefore entirely conditional upon its own domestic, economic, technological, industrial development. Now, if you pay any attention to what Putin and other officials will be saying, you will see you will see that Melnichenko, what Melnichenko is saying, he's talking about a sovereign Russia, is barely different from what Putin himself has been saying, or from Putin talking points. I don't consider Melnichenko to be an important person in Russian decision making at the present time. The whole magazine article in The Economist, which is enormous, by the way, to me simply provides a further illustration of how completely out of touch with Russian realities Westerners continue to be, or at least influential Westerners continue to be, and the extent to which their perceptions of Russia and of Russian decision-making continue to be influenced by established long-term biases and wishful thinking. Anyway, the war will continue. Donbass, at some point over the next few months, will fall. There's been a very interesting analysis of the situation on the front lines by the Russian military analyst Sergei Poletayev. He's provided a very interesting account of the Battle of Konstantinovka, suggesting that the Russians suffered relatively light casualties in capturing the city, which is captured mostly intact, just saying. And, well, what Poletayev said, and I found this very interesting, is that one of the reasons that the Russians are able to capture very heavily fortified positions, and he describes the enormous extent of the fortifications in Konstantinovka. One of the reasons why the Russians are able to capture these positions is partly because the Russians have developed tactics that make that easier and possible. They've refined tactics to do it. But mostly because Ukraine is now so short of infantry, or at least of good infantry, that it has to leave large spaces of territory empty, allowing the Russians to practice their infiltration tactics. And, well, what that suggests to me is that though FPV drones are very useful and very effective when there is an organized defense, in the absence of an organized defense on the ground, there is only so much that the FPV drones can do. The talk about a drone wall, in other words, is basically wrong and is based on a misunderstanding. Well, this is what I would say about the one war, the war that is being fought in Ukraine. There is the other war, the war that is being fought out in the Persian Gulf. And there are reports that the United States has now given Iran an ultimatum to agree to the unconditional opening of the Strait of Hormuz, allowing shipping to pass through unimpeded without Iran levying tolls. Now that, by the way, would be a substantive rewriting of the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding, though, to be frank, I think that document is to all intents and purposes dead. What the United States is going to do if the Iranians reject that ultimatum, as of course they will, well, we shall have to wait and see. Again, it seems to me that there is clear signs of a miscalculation here. The one thing I would say about Iran is that, yes, this is a very fragmented political system, and that there are divisions that constantly manifest themselves within the Iranian leadership. But the one thing all Iranian factions appear to have in common is a strong dislike, an extreme aversion to ultimatums. They reject ultimatums, and that is certainly what they're now going to do. If the United States wants to unite the entire Iranian government into a hostile position, then I suspect, this is my view, that it is going about it the right way. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel.